Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. And you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Charles Geschke, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm your chair for today's program. Today's program is part of a series of programs that is underwritten by the Geschke Family Foundation. This Commonwealth Club series on the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century examines the balance between safety, security, and public order on the one hand, and the protection of civil liberties and the integrity of the Constitution on the other. The series aims to break new ground by delving into recent interpretations of the U.S. Constitution and discussing potential new directions for the Obama administration. Before introducing our speaker, I would like to mention that today's question and answer portion of the program will be moderated by Peter King, who is Professor of Law and Dean Emeritus at the Golden Gate Law School. Professor King is the former president of the Bar Association of San Francisco and the former vice president of the State Bar of California. I'd also like to welcome Laura Hubbard, who is actually the mother of Chris Perry, who was the litigant in the case that Judge Vaughn adjudicated on the issue of same-sex marriage. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, retired Chief U.S. District Court Judge Vaughn Walker. The Honorable Vaughn Walker, who is now retired, was a judge of the United States District Court, Northern District of California, from February 1990 through February 2011. In April 2011, Judge Walker returned to private practice, focusing on arbitration and mediation services. Judge Walker was nominated by President George H.W. Bush and earlier by President Reagan, and confirmed by the United States Senate in November of 1989. He was the chief judge from September 2004 until December 31st, 2010. Judge Walker is a 1966 graduate of the University of Michigan. He worked briefly at the Securities and Exchange Commission and was a Woodrow Wilson Fellow in Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He studied law at the University of Chicago and Stanford University and earned his J.D. in 1970. From 1971 to 1972, Judge Walker was law clerk to the Honorable Robert J. Kelleher of the United States District Court in Los Angeles. From 1972 to 1990, he practiced law with Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro, which has now been renamed Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman, in San Francisco, becoming a partner in 1978. In 2010, Judge Walker tried Perry versus Schwarzenegger, an action challenging a California ballot initiative precluding the state from recognizing marriages between same-sex couples. Judge Walker found the initiative measure invalid and ruled it unconstitutional. In 21 years on the federal bench, Judge Walker handled about 8,000 cases, more than 250 trials, numerous settlement conferences, and sat by designation on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and the Federal Circuit. This spring, Judge Walker co-taught with Professor Francis McGovern a complex litigation course at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and is teaching a course on litigation strategies at Stanford Law School. Judge Walker served as a member of the Civil Rules Advisory Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States, is the former chair of the St. Francis Foundation, and a member of the American Law Institute and a variety of other professional organizations. He's a former member of the California Law Revision Commission, president of the Lawyers Club of San Francisco, and judicial representative of the American Bar Association section of antitrust law. Please welcome Judge Walker.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I guess I won't need this gavel. I don't use a gavel anymore in my present line of work. It's a pleasure to be asked to speak to the Commonwealth Club of California. It's certainly an organization that I've been involved with over the years. I've attended many wonderful talks at the Commonwealth Club, and so it is a real pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see old friends. It's a pleasure to see some who I have seen in court before, and a pleasure to know, at least, that the mother of one of the litigants in a case I had is with us today. Now, as the introduction indicated, I left the bench about a year ago and went back into the private sector. And it is the thoughts and impressions of that migration back into the private sector that I want to talk to you about this afternoon. In a way, I feel a little bit like Rip Van Winkle. You recall Rip, to get away from his termagant wife, as Washington Irving described her, went into the woods, was induced to have some elixir by some elf-like characters dressed in old Dutch costume, and enjoyed it and went to sleep for 20 years. In the meantime, the American Revolution occurred. In the meantime, all the changes that occur in a 20-year period of time transpired in the village where Rip lived. So when he went back into his village and went down to the tavern where he had whiled away so many hours, he discovered that what had been hanging over the tavern, the image of George III, was now the image of George Washington. And, of course, he was asking, who is that man? Well, I've gone back into the private sector, into the private law sector. And like Rip, the question that occurs to me is, look how it has changed. Why, who put the client in charge? Let me set the stage for that, perhaps the answer to that question, or at least an answer to that question, by referring to two statements that I do think help set the stage. The first was by Justice Robert H. Jackson of the Supreme Court when he spoke at the laying of the cornerstone of the American Bar Association building in Chicago in November 1953. Said Justice Jackson, "Only through the private law office can the citizen learn the increasingly complicated rules which bear upon his peculiar rights to obtain effective access to any except the minor courts. To these offices every day come countless men and women in grief or greed, in anger or distress." He did have a way with words. Well, the model, of course, that Justice Jackson had in mind was that the focal point between the client and justice or the legal system was that private law office. That is where the client accessed the justice system. And that was still largely the case when I went on the bench now 22 years ago. One client accessed one lawyer, or perhaps a group of lawyers, either directly face-to-face in a law office or on the telephone. Personal interaction. Now contrast that concept with a concept that my friend Bill Davidow, one of the great venture capital investors in Silicon Valley, in his Atlantic blog recently pointed out. In alluding to the power of the Internet to increase the contribution of individual workers in the economy, and doing so by taking the middleman out of the economic picture. Bill notes that the gross national product, the gross domestic product of the United States, is about $15 trillion. There are a little over 130 million non-farm workers employed in the United States, which means that each worker contributes about $100,000 to domestic output. But for companies in what has come to be called the technology space, those numbers are quite different. Google has a little more than 32,000 employees and generates about $1.2 million in sales per employee. And Facebook, about the same. Amazon, with 56,000 employees, generated a little over $800,000 per employee in terms of revenue. Well, economists call the process that enables Google and Amazon to generate such high levels of revenue per employee disintermediation. In lay terms, of course, that's taking the middleman out. It's a process that enables these companies to deliver more of what their customers want at less cost. It's a mixed blessing. Bookstores, as we know, are closing by the dozens as buyers of books, records, and other items find they can obtain these products through Amazon at less cost and with greater efficiency. Newspapers have been particularly hard hit in that the provision of news, information, advertising is now largely through the Internet. Craigslist and other web-based services have drained countless lines of classified advertising from newspapers, which were once the most profitable kind of advertising in newspapers. And broadcast media and cable television, too, are seeing their businesses migrate to their web-based competitors. Well, lawyers never thought that this would happen to them. After all, lawyers offer individualized service and analytical skills that cannot, or so the lawyers thought, be delivered by a software program or a web-based service. Well, unfortunately for the lawyers, they were wrong. Lawyers, after all, are middlemen, and the effect on the profession has been substantial. It's a profession transformed. Thielen, Marin, Johnson, and Bridges. Max Thielen, of course, was a great Commonwealth Club member, and that law firm, a pillar of the legal community in San Francisco. Heller, Ehrman, White, and McAuliffe. Brobeck, Flager, and Harrison. If you had told me 20 years ago or so when I was going on the bench that when I came out after 20 years, those firms would not be in existence, I wouldn't have believed you. But they're gone without a trace. And, as was alluded in the introduction, my old firm, Pillsbury Madison & Sutro, is no longer the firm that it was. It's now Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman as a result of mergers with firms in New York and Washington. And McCutcheon, Doyle, Brown, and Enerson, now Bingham McCutcheon, thanks to a merger with basically a Boston-based law firm. Those firms, in the center of gravity, have migrated east. And firms that still operate under the old names, Morrison Forrester, Orrick Herrington, Gibson Dunn & Crutcher, O'Melveny & Myers, these firms are firms that have either a national practice or, in some instances, an international practice. And observers of the legal scene predict that the migration east is going to continue even further east, and that in the years ahead, the center of gravity of some firms that are quintessentially American firms are going to be in Asia, maybe Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong. If you go to the law office of virtually every firm, major firm in San Francisco, and the same is true all around the country, and walk down the halls, you will find empty space, unless recently the firm has moved and migrated to a smaller office. That's because the number of people necessary to deliver the legal services that these firms delivered are fewer and fewer. It's true in terms of lawyers, and it's certainly true in terms of support personnel. When I left the practice, essentially at the end of 1989, I had a personal secretary, full-time, who took dictation. That is about the rarest bird you can find in a law office today. Today, lawyers sit behind computer terminals. They prepare their own documents. They do their own filings without messengers. They compile materials, and they don't need the library that once existed because they have at their fingertips, on their computer, essentially resources the equivalent to that which existed before and indeed a richer resource. Essentially, all of the resources of the Library of Congress, for example. Well, what's going on here? Let me offer a thought. Lawyers offer basically two kinds of services: dispute resolution and avoidance on the one hand, and mediation between the state and the individual on the other. Your speaker this afternoon, Dale Carpenter, is going to be speaking more about the latter, the mediation between the individual and the state, when he addresses the Lawrence v. Texas case and the very interesting book that he's written on that case decided by the Supreme Court in 2003. I'm going to focus on the other, perhaps the more mundane aspect of what lawyers do and where the legal system operates. But in all probability, if you have an interaction with the legal system, it's more likely to be in what I've termed the more mundane than in the former. At least I hope that not too many of you are going to require the kind of mediation between the state and yourselves that sometimes individuals have to engage in. So I want to focus on this kind of workaday aspect of the legal profession. And of the two areas I mentioned, I'm going to focus more on dispute resolution because I was a litigator and a trial judge, and that's more my métier. But let's take a moment to talk about dispute avoidance. By another term, that is frequently called transactional work. It consists of writing contracts, regulatory submissions, negotiating, interacting with public and private parties for one purpose or the other. The essence of that kind of work is to get something accomplished within the constraints of the law and the needs of the parties. Today, in a host of areas, it is possible for an individual to access legal services through a website. These virtual law offices are like the virtual bookstore that Amazon operates. The knowledge of lawyers no longer requires interpersonal consultation with a human advisor. Now, these sites are, of course, limited in what the scope and sophistication of what they can offer, but there's little doubt that their capabilities are growing and will continue to become more robust with advancing technology. Furthermore, due at least in part to budget constraints that more and more courts and public agencies face and will face in the future, these courts and agencies will be forced to provide access to their services through these impersonal channels. The Internet and other technologies will permit them to do so. Now, the cost of setting up these systems effectively to provide this access will be and has been considerable. The California judiciary learned this lesson the hard way, unfortunately. It had to abandon an e-filing system that would have integrated the files of all of the courts throughout the entire state of California. And unfortunately, sunk millions of dollars into that project, which, because of a variety of factors, it came to naught and had to be abandoned. The result, unfortunately, of failing to make that investment in a workable system will result eventually in a deterioration of service. And this, too, will have an impact not only on the legal profession, but on the public. Probably the best known of these types of software are probably some software programs that you use, or at least a number of people here use, TurboTax. This enables a reasonably literate, computer literate, user to run the gauntlet of the Internal Revenue Code and to do so without hiring a lawyer or an accountant. And there are many other such programs. Willmaker, that tells you all you need to know about what it does. There are programs that will allow you to form your own corporation, obtain a divorce, establish a living trust, prepare a lease, and a myriad of other fairly routine legal tasks, all without the assistance of a lawyer. Now, as I said, those services are, of course, limited, and the capabilities are not suitable for the more complicated legal problems. But the robustness of these services and the programs are growing, and they will continue to grow. Indeed, a number of law firms are getting into the business of developing and marketing proprietary programs for their own clients and for the market generally. At the other end of the spectrum, not the fairly routine consumer-type dispute avoidance practice, there is the rise of the general counsel's office in most large entities. In fact, almost all entities of any size will have a staff of in-house lawyers, and oftentimes a very large staff of in-house lawyers, who address the legal needs of that organization. And the in-house lawyers can provide better service in many instances because they can devote themselves entirely to the work and business of their employer. They learn the businesses in a way that an outside lawyer cannot, and they learn the law that is applicable to these business operations. The general counsel at major entities now enjoy compensation levels commensurate with that of partners at major law firms and enjoy prestige in the profession on a par with those of major law firm partners. Well, all of these trends at the two ends of the spectrum have enabled clients to take more control of their legal problems than was possible two decades ago. And the ability of clients to take control of their legal work has extended to the domain of litigation, once considered the exclusive province of lawyers. And this has occurred in a number of ways. First, clients are better able to track just what lawyers do for them in litigation through much more sophisticated billing, tracking, and information exchange. Second, clients are able to outsource a number of litigation tasks to lower-cost providers. Document review, once the bane of young lawyers and paralegals, working under lawyers can increasingly be performed and performed quite well by essentially mechanical means. And because most information these days is digitized, it can be read by a computer short-circuiting the once laborious and expensive process of lawyer-paralegal review. Third, the rise of alternative dispute resolution, the business basically that I'm now in, enables clients to participate in the resolution of their disputes in a far more robust way than the traditional litigation model. Clients can and do dialogue directly with the mediator or arbitrator in a way that a client simply cannot in a traditional litigation setting. Now, of course, this is not always a happy conversation, but the client is able to tell his or her story directly to the decision maker or mediator in a much more human setting than is possible in a courtroom. And fourth, pro se litigation is an area where the client, of course, is in complete control of the litigation, and it's growing. Pro se litigation in the court that I sat in the Northern District of California, now constitutes about a third of all of the cases filed. These are cases in which the client does everything himself or herself, files the case, prepares the pleadings, goes to court, argues the motions or whatever it happens to be, and if necessary, tries the case and prosecutes an appeal. Most in the Northern District of California, such cases are prisoner cases, cases brought by persons who are confined to state custody and who challenge either their confinement or the conditions of their confinement. Thanks to my predecessor as Chief Judge, Marilyn Hall Patel, we developed in the Northern District of California some innovative ways of dealing with these troublesome cases. We ensured that those cases would be reviewed in the first instance by the district judges rather than is true in many other districts where they are first reviewed by magistrate judges and then a report and recommendation is prepared to the district judge, thus essentially doubling the amount of judicial work that goes into the cases. And secondly, developed a very able group of pro se law clerks who review these cases, who are extremely knowledgeable in the applicable law, and are able to prepare memoranda, proposed orders, and so forth to assist the judge in dealing with these cases in a reasonably effective fashion. Now, the non-prisoner pro se cases, of course, present a particular difficulty, but thanks largely to former magistrate judge, now district judge Edward M. Chen, we developed in the Northern District of California a pro se help desk to assist non-prisoner pro se litigants, including, where appropriate, assisting the litigant to find representation or other assistance. And sometimes, of course, that assistance is not just legal assistance. It's medical, employment, social, economic, or other assistance. that is appropriate for the individual. Now, to be sure, the most frequent reason that these pro se litigants are representing themselves is the lack of merit to their cases. But that is certainly not always the case. And there's no reason why that those individuals should, if they have a meritorious claim, should not have it treated properly by the judiciary. Where a pro se case has survived to the point of a trial or preparation for trial, the district has called upon the bar to step in to represent the client, and sometimes that a representation is willingly accepted. The bar has certainly responded ably and well to those requests. But notwithstanding these innovations in this district, pro se litigation does remain a very troubling aspect of our court's workload. But the growth of this type of litigation is simply one more example of the client taking charge. In the main, the client taking charge is a good thing, notwithstanding the fact that it has made the lives and practices of some lawyers more challenging. But there is one important area where the trend has not advanced very far, and it's to that area that I'd like to devote the balance of my conversation with you this afternoon. This is the area of what is called aggregate litigation. It is, I submit, the absence of client control that has contributed substantially to the negative impression that this type of litigation has in the minds of many observers, both inside and outside the profession. Although there are many types of aggregate litigation, the best known, of course, is the class action. In aggregate litigation, individual input from clients has historically been limited and often wholly absent. The parties represented, and it's usually the plaintiffs, of course, although Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure provides that a class may sue or be sued, and there have in a few instances been defendant classes. But by and large, these are plaintiff classes. And the plaintiffs, the members of the class, typically have little or no contact with the lawyers handling the litigation. They have little or no knowledge of the strategy the lawyers are pursuing. They have little or no knowledge of the discovery in the case. They have little or no knowledge of the evidence in the case. And they sometimes have no understanding at all about the litigation. If the clients learn anything about the litigation, it is often through a notice received in the mail or otherwise communicated to them, frequently accompanied by an offer of a recovery, which they're not in a position to evaluate. Often the recovery is for a relatively small sum, possibly for no monetary relief at all. And in this scenario, clients are usually told that the lawyer representing the class is going to receive a handsome fee. Well, it's little wonder that the client feels ignored and dissatisfied with this kind of an arrangement. So it's the lack of client involvement in litigation, in class actions and other forms of aggregate litigation, that has unfortunately in some instances encouraged undesirable behavior on the part of the lawyers engaged in that practice. Lawyers representing a class of individuals have not always been candid with these individuals and may have been tempted to take advantage of persons who the lawyers have never met and are unlikely ever to meet. Unfortunately, this has occurred too often to the detriment of the many highly reputable and able lawyers who practice in this field, and to the detriment of the bar generally and the justice system. When it comes to the evaluation of what constitutes a fair and reasonable settlement, or a fair and reasonable fee, and fair and reasonable expenses, most persons whose rights are adjudicated in the class action are simply not in a position to contribute anything meaningful or informed about that decision. So the judges who have to make decisions on such matters essentially have before them very scarce information, very little information upon which to make a reasoned appraisal. Because at the time a settlement proposal is presented, both sides join hands and join in the proposal. It's one of those few instances in which a judge is confronted with a non-adversarial presentation. And what judges depend upon, of course, is an adversarial presentation, the clash of positions, and so often in aggregate litigation, particularly in class actions, that adversarial presentation is wholly lacking. Now, a few of us on the bench in the early 1990s attempted to tackle at least the fee part of the problem in the representation of a class in securities litigation by essentially putting those cases out to some form of competitive counsel selection, essentially a bidding kind of an arrangement. I started that in 1990. A number of other judges, including a number of judges in this district, picked up on that. The most innovative and, I thought, creative approach was that used by Judge Lewis Kaplan in the Southern District of New York in some antitrust litigation that David Boyce, who handled the one of the lawyers handling the Proposition 8 case that was referred to in the introduction, represented a plaintiff class, recovered a substantial recovery for the class, and also, I might add, a very handsome fee. But in that situation, because of the competitive selection process, the members of the class had the knowledge that the selection of the lawyer had been made through a competitive process and the fee was established in a competitive process, which gave it a credibility that it otherwise would lack. Now, this endeavor, the competitive selection process of selecting class counsel in securities cases, was largely displaced by the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1996. And that act, of course, in itself was a response to the bad odor that had developed about securities class actions. And while the act attempted a quite sensible solution to the problem of the lack of client control in the selection of counsel and the determination of counsel's compensation, it did, unfortunately, impose other problematic requirements. The problem stemming from the lack of control by the clients was addressed in the Act by the most adequate plaintiff approach to selecting the representative plaintiff. That is to say, the investor in the class who had the largest stake in the outcome was presumed to be the most adequate plaintiff to represent the class, and if willing to step forward and undertake that representation, would be given the task to essentially ride herd on the lawyers to make the decisions about the litigation as the litigation goes forward, the decision to settle, how to litigate the case, and so forth. A reasonable approach. And some of us had actually used that approach in litigation before the Act itself. But other provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Act proved unhelpful in the extreme. The particularized pleading requirement has not advanced the prompt and sensible resolution of these cases, but has simply magnified the expense and burden of these cases. Now, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act is an exception to the general rule that clients have little or no involvement in the control of aggregate litigation. But here, once again, technology does offer some promise, although it's going to require courts taking some steps that heretofore they have been reluctant to take. With electronic filing and distribution of papers, it's possible to increase exponentially the number of persons receiving court filings. Now virtually anyone with access to a computer with an internet connection can access court filings. Evidence related to individual claims and evidence can be made widely available and evaluated by all of those who need to evaluate it. Video transmissions of court hearings can be made available through court or private facilities. Chat rooms and social media offer the opportunity to network and communicate among clients and attorneys. We're really at the very early stages of developing what can be a very promising way of increasing the involvement of clients in this kind of litigation. Regrettably, the realization of the promise of these technologies has in part been frustrated by the Supreme Court's refusal to accept that cameras and videos have an appropriate place in our federal courtrooms, and I would argue in the Supreme Court itself, although that may be a different issue. And indeed, this antipathy to class actions is displayed in some of the recent decisions of the Supreme Court. The decision in the Dukes versus Walmart case and the more recent decision in what is called the AT&T Mobility or the Concepcion case. Dukes, essentially, requires the judge who's handling one of these class actions to delve into the merits of the case before certifying a class. Not at all clear what the effect of that scrutiny on the merits accompanying the class certification decision is going to how that will play out. And the Concepcion or AT&T Mobility case was a consumer class action in which a group of individuals who signed up for a mobile telephone service from AT&T that AT&T represented was going to be free were nevertheless charged the sales tax for this service, $30.62, if memory serves correct. And they thought, my goodness, we thought this was going to be a free service, and here we're having to pay the sales tax on it. So they brought a class action. But the contract that they signed contained what was called a class action waiver. Obviously, it would not pay any individual consumer to bring an action to recover $30.62, but by way of a class action, it became feasible. Except, of course, in that situation, they were confronted with a waiver of their class action rights that otherwise might have attended. Now, the Supreme Court's decision, I think of the two decisions, the dissent by Justice Breyer, in my view, stands better scrutiny than the majority opinion. But it may very well be in that particular situation that the result, the outcome going forward, will not be bad, because the AT&T contract provided quite robust remedies to any consumer who felt that he or she had been shortchanged by this process. Thus, although the class action remedy was taken away and that withdrawal was upheld by the Supreme Court, nonetheless, there was a remedy which was available to consumers in that case, and should that be the view of the courts going forward with respect to these class action waivers, it may very well be that that result will not be unhelpful to consumers. Now, why you say, with this bad odor that has attended class actions, would I look at that situation with some, if not alarm, at least some worry? Class actions and aggregate litigation offer two advantages that cannot be achieved in individual litigation. First and foremost, and most obviously, there are efficiencies in the use of resources devoted to litigation and the resolution of claims that can be achieved in aggregate litigation that cannot be achieved in traditional individual case-by-case litigation. The transactions cost of individually litigating claims frequently consume a large share of the resources devoted to litigation. My friend Francis McGovern, who was referred to in the introduction, has calculated that in the asbestos litigation, of all of the money that has been spent in that litigation over the years, less than 20%, he calculates, I believe, 17 or 18%, comes down to recoveries to those who have established some form of injury. The rest goes to the transactions cost of this litigation. In addition, of course, the only way that the defendants in those cases have been able to achieve a form of global peace to resolve all of these claims is through the bankruptcy process, and that, too, is an unattractive solution. So aggregate litigation offers some efficiencies that should not be overlooked. Kenneth Feinberg, who's done a masterful job as the, not special master, but as a lawyer in the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, has resolved through a claims process approximately 220,000 claims to which BP has devoted some $6.5 billion. And presently there is pending before Judge Barbier of the Eastern District of Louisiana a class settlement that would essentially resolve all of the remaining claims. That means that the individuals who had injuries that they were able to substantiate either economic losses or other kinds of losses, would obtain recoveries. And the defendants in that case would be able to corral those claims, deal with them, put those claims behind them, and go on with their business. That is one of the signal advantages of this kind of litigation, its ability to resolve huge numbers of cases and to do so with an efficiency that simply is not achievable in any other form of litigation. And secondly, class and aggregate litigation offers the opportunity to achieve some horizontal and vertical equities that are very difficult to achieve in traditional litigation except over a large number of cases. Those of us who've been in this business a long time think that the justice system works pretty well. It's certainly not perfect, but over a large number of cases, the results tend to be very sensible and very reasonable. But you have no assurance that that's going to be the situation in any one case, where the results will often follow a kind of a random pattern. Well, in aggregate or class litigation, resolutions can be developed which achieve vertical and horizontal equity. That is, that like claims, like cases, are treated the same, horizontal equity, or vertical equity, the more serious claims are treated more seriously. You can do that in aggregate and class litigation in a way that simply is not achievable in any other form of litigation. So, although the role of what lawyers do and the essence of their work in society remains as it has traditionally been, to resolve, to avoid disputes among private actors, and to mediate between the state and the individual, how lawyers are now going about this task, and a worthy task it is, has changed dramatically from the time 20-plus years ago that I, like Rip Van Winkle, entered the quiet and relative slumber of the federal judiciary. And like Rip wandering into his village, seeing the image of George Washington over the village tavern and asking, "Who is that man?" I go back into the private legal world and ask, "Who put the client in charge?" Thank you very much. People want to stay up. Well, Peter, they're coming to get us.
They are. And we knew it would happen someday. Our thanks to Judge Walker, retired Chief U.S. District Judge for the Northern District of California. I'm Peter Keene, Professor of Law and Dean Emeritus of Golden Gate Law School, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Judge Walker, we have a number of questions, so let's begin. And the questions range over lots of profound topics, so I thought I'd begin with what has to be the most profound of all. How did you feel about Brad Pitt playing you in the film 8? And the questioner says, "I thought he did a great job."
Well, I could have thought of people I'd rather not have play me. actually, it was kind of an unintended benefit of the Supreme Court's decision not to permit the video transmission of that Proposition 8 case. It prompted a number of people to essentially recreate the case in a variety of forms. One group has taken the transcript of that case and, with actors, has reenacted the entire trial, word for word, all 2+ weeks of it. And that's posted on the Internet. The particular presentation that Brad Pitt was involved in is about an hour and a half play that was done by the playwright and screenwriter who wrote Milk some time ago, and he distilled that trial, that Proposition 8 trial, into about an hour and a half of a dramatic presentation. And the irony of this is that probably far more people have seen that than would have sat through the actual trial itself. For the fact of the matter is that even the most interesting and best trials are usually full of a lot of tedium. And though that trial had many high points and relatively little tedium, I doubt very much that the public would have sat through all 2 weeks of it. So Brad Pitt was an unintended beneficiary of the Supreme Court.
Judge Walker, after the Proposition 8 rulings in the trial that you did, the proponents of Proposition 8 criticized you for not publicly disclosing your sexual orientation prior to presiding over the trial. Does the criticism have any merit, and did you consider before the trial that there might be any problem to your presiding because of your personal sexual orientation?
I didn't anticipate a problem because the word was out and had been publicly disclosed and published in a number of sources. And the proponents of Proposition 8 indicated before the trial was over that they were not going to raise the matter. So I figured that that was not going to be an issue. I had thought, frankly, that at some point or other in my career that this would be something that I'd have to deal with in some fashion, because ironically, I came to the bench being severely criticized by the gay community, particularly in San Francisco, for having represented the United States Olympic Committee successfully in trademark litigation to enforce their rights to the term Olympic against a group that wanted to put on the athletic contest that they wanted to call the Gay Olympics. I thought I'd get into hot water when I was nominated for cases I'd lost as a lawyer. Instead, I got into hot water for a case that I won and a case that established some significant law in that area. So I figured at some point or other in my judicial career, having been criticized for that, and much of the criticism was that the reason I took that particular case and litigated it in the fashion that I did was because I was trying to cover up my own sexuality. So when all of that kind of went away with a whimper, it never really occurred to me that the kind of pushback would come that came after the result in the Proposition 8 case. And I will say simply further to that, to answer the other part of your question, that is really a very dangerous road for people to go down. When you start questioning a judge's decision because of innate characteristics of the judge, be it a female judge, a black judge, an Asian judge, you name the characteristic, judges not only have to be given the credit to have their decisions accepted for what they are, but in addition, one of the things that a judge learns, particularly after a number of years on the bench, is that the criticism of your decisions is basically, in most instances, not a personal criticism at all. It may be a criticism of how you'd handle the case, how you ran the trial or proceeding in some fashion, how you reasoned it, but you simply can't take it personally. And to single out particularly minority judges on the basis of their innate characteristics would be a very, very dangerous road to go down.
In regard to criticism of judicial opinions, a number of people have responded to the Supreme Court's ruling in Bush versus Gore and Citizens United, and also the questions in oral argument recently in the healthcare case, that the court itself is pursuing a political Republican agenda. Should the court as a branch of government be immune from this kind of criticism?
Well, of course it shouldn't be immune from criticism. But the kind of criticism that has been leveled is oftentimes very ill-informed. In fact, I was pretty shocked to hear the comments of the President of the United States following the health care argument in the Supreme Court when he suggested exactly what your questioner has presented. That doesn't sound like a former president of the Harvard Law Review or somebody who taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago. He surely knows that the Supreme Court has for 209 years had the power of judicial review, and it's perfectly appropriate for it to review legislation and where it becomes convinced that the legislation is unconstitutional to make that finding. Further, I think the decision was basically a blunder, excuse me, on the president's part, in that it will appear, if the Supreme Court upholds this particular piece of legislation, that it will create the impression that the Supreme Court has succumbed to the political pressure of the president's criticism. And if it overturns the legislation, then that will give credence to the rumor that's floating around that one of the justices on the Supreme Court leaked the outcome of the vote on the Supreme Court prematurely to the president. So from both a constitutional point of view and a political point of view, that comment by the president was a very serious mistake on his part.
Judge Walker, Wikipedia states that you believe in a legal approach known as law and economics. Is this true, and could you briefly explain?
Well, that comes, I suppose, from having spent a little time at the University of Chicago, and also when I studied law at Stanford, studied under Richard Posner, who is, if might be fair to call him the grandfather or the father of law and economics scholarship in the judiciary. He's a judge on the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, an outstanding scholar and a wonderful teacher. So I'm sure that as we all assume some of the learning of our teachers, I picked up some thinking about law and economics, and I did study economics beforehand. And economic scholarship does offer a number of insights that are very helpful in resolving legal matters because it focuses on the incentives of the parties in one direction or the other. But it is certainly not the be-all and end-all of legal scholarship, and certainly no one, I think, is a pure law and economics person in our profession. There's a lot more that goes into it than simply a demand and supply curve.
Judge Walker, in the Perry case, you ruled that sexual orientation was a protected class under the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause. The U.S. Supreme Court has provided protection to sexual orientation in cases like the Texas anti-sodomy decision and striking down the anti-gay Colorado initiative without holding sexual orientation to be a higher protected class. How come you went further in that, in your case?
Well, actually, I determined that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional without the application of strict scrutiny, that under a rational basis test, it failed, that there was, in fact, no rational basis, even without determining that gays and lesbians are a protected class.
One of the questions is, I was trained as a lawyer, worked in a large firm, and left to start a website for law students. As you'd imagine, readers often ask whether they should apply to law schools. What do you what do you advise aspiring lawyers to consider given the changes in the profession?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think it's going to be the traditional practice that those of us who came out of law school in the early 70s confronted and took advantage of. The growth in revenues of law firms was very substantially between the time, I can't tell you just exactly when it began, but approximately in the 1960s until about the last 5 to 10 years. And that provided a very rewarding economic environment for lawyers. For some of the reasons that I discussed in my comments, I think that is going to be less true going forward and has been less true for the last few years. So I think the soundest advice that could be given to anyone interested in a legal career is to, by all means, pursue it if it's what interests you and what you like to do and enjoy doing. It's a fascinating profession. And obviously, it's a very rewarding profession intellectually and can be a very rewarding profession in terms of the satisfaction that you obtain. The economic rewards may not be as great going forward as they have been in the past, but nonetheless, if this is what turns you on, by all means, do it, and you won't regret it.
Could you talk about the AT&T wiretapping case in light of today's situation with the government's assuming more and more rights to surveil American citizens?
Those cases were about the most difficult cases that I handled as a judge, in that the problem that I confronted was dealing with classified information that I had access to, but no one else did except the lawyers for the government, the lawyers representing the plaintiffs, the lawyers on the other side of the case did not have access to it, and no one on the court had access to any of this information, so I didn't have the usual support that you have with the assistants that judges have, law clerks and other assistants. And not simply the lack of assistance was the problem. The larger problem was the dilemma that a judge is in when he or she is given information from one side but cannot share it with the other side. I considered at some length not reviewing the classified information at all, figuring that I would not have the adversarial presentation that judges depend upon in making a decision. And if I did not have to review the information, or if I could justify not reviewing the information, then that would kind of even the playing field. But ultimately, I decided that it wouldn't be fair to do that because of the concern that if there were some information in these materials that I were to ignore because I hadn't reviewed the materials and that were in some fashion to endanger the national security, that would be highly irresponsible. So that was a very tough dilemma. And ultimately, I decided I had to review the information and make a decision. Fortunately, however, as the case played out, at least the main case played out, I think it was possible to review the case and to decide the case based only upon publicly disclosed information without necessarily having to get into that classified information. So when that opportunity presented itself, I took it.
What was the most satisfying and fulfilling thing about your years as a federal district court judge? And at the same time, what things, if any, did you find frustrating or not so satisfying?
People often ask, what was the case that you enjoyed the most or that you liked the most? The one that was the most enjoyable was the newspaper antitrust case in which the Hearst Corporation acquisition of the San Francisco Chronicle was at issue. That was a wonderful case. If all cases had been like that, I would be a judge forever. It was an antitrust case, and that was a field that I was very interested in and had been for a long time. It involved newspapers. Newspapers are always colorful. It involved San Francisco history, and that's a colorful history. And it had wonderful lawyers, and it was a fascinating time in court. So that was truly one of the most enjoyable experiences that one could have as a judge. But I think the most satisfying aspect of the work that I did on the bench was the work on the Federal Rules Advisory Committee. That was an appointment by the Chief Justice to serve on that committee, which is part of the Rules Enabling Act, or the rules process by which the rules of procedure of the federal courts are developed and amended. And it truly opened up avenues of thought about how our system works in a way that dealing with cases one by one you simply cannot achieve. And so I think that was probably the most rewarding time on the bench. There certainly were, on the other side of the question that you asked, certainly were a number of cases that were of some frustration for one reason or another. Frequently where one party is significantly out-represented by the other party, and the judge has to essentially try to even the scales of justice. Those are always very difficult cases because there's always a tendency for us all, once we take a side in a case, to attempt to become an advocate for that side of the case. And, in fact, your job as a judge is to not become an advocate but simply a decision maker. So those are probably the most difficult and trying kinds of decisions that repeatedly come forward.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Judge Vaughn Walker, retired Chief U.S. District Judge of Northern California. Judge Walker presided over the 2010 case, which challenged Proposition 8, a ballot initiative precluding the state from recognizing marriages between same-sex couples. Judge Walker found the initiative measure invalid and unconstitutional. Back to our questions. Judge Walker, do you have any projections about the final outcome of the Prop 8 case? Do you think the outcome depends solely on the present justices on the Supreme Court, or do changing attitudes in society about same-sex relationships help the case?
Well, as you know, my decision was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit on narrower grounds than I had decided the case. But like any judge who's affirmed, I'm happy to take it. One of my former colleagues once observed when he had been affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, "I still think I'm right." And I think that's my answer to your question.
Very good. Judge Walker, the President has concluded that the Defense of Marriage Act is not constitutional and instructed the Attorney General not to enforce it. Shouldn't this be determined by the courts?
Oh, it will be. There's no question it will be decided by the courts. There's some question that the Proposition 8 case will go forward to the Supreme Court, particularly in view of the narrow grounds on which the Ninth Circuit decided it. The Supreme Court could turn down that case, deferring the question of the constitutionality of state statutes under the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the Constitution to withstand scrutiny. So the Supreme Court could conceivably not review the Proposition 8 case, but it seems to me there's no way in the world it can avoid having to decide the federal Defense of Marriage Act. That's a federal law. Supreme Court's in the business of deciding whether federal laws are constitutional or not.
We have time for just one more question, Judge Walker, and the questioner asks, could you please discuss your view of the future status of same-sex marriage generally?
Well, you know, I started out to be an antitrust lawyer. And it seems that so many of the questions here involve the same-sex marriage case and the same-sex marriage issue. There is some, perhaps, similarity between same-sex marriage and the antitrust doctrines. After all, in both you have both vertical and horizontal relationships. And so I don't know, in fact, where this issue is going in the long term. I do know the case and the evidence that was before me. It was exceedingly ably tried and actually well tried on both sides. The lawyers representing the proponents are very able lawyers, and so I'm sure that it's going to go forward, and it will be decided one way or the other. Exactly what the sequence will be, I'm not sure. But it does seem to me that the notion of people deciding to get married and to obtain the benefits of the marital relationship without regard to gender is an idea whose time has come and which is being ever more widely accepted. And eventually, that will be the outcome.
Our thanks to Judge Vaughn Walker. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's U.S. Constitution in the 21st Century series, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. I'm Peter Keene, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.